Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, May 1st. State lawmakers end the legislative session tomorrow. Already there have been some last-minute twists and turns. At the 11th hour, we get the latest. The State Attorney General's office speaks candidly about the battle that it's waging over President Donald Trump's actions, which has spurred Hawaii joining in 14 legal challenges with other states. We hear from a labor leader about a silent march planned starting at 5 p.m. today, standing up for federal workers on this International Workers' Day. And we talk mass transit, buses, and rail on the Longview. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. State lawmakers will wrap up this legislative session tomorrow. Our government reporter Ashley Mizuo joins us this morning with the view on things as we head toward the finish line. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I understand there was some high drama about a gun bill that got killed at the 11th hour.
Yeah. I think before we start talking about what did pass, maybe we talk about what didn't pass. And one of the big surprises was there was a law on the table that would have banned the sale of assault rifles. Those are semi-automatic assault rifle weapons. It made it out of committee and it was up for a final vote yesterday. But at the very last minute, Senator Linda Coit submitted a floor amendment, and this floor amendment severely weakened the bill, almost to the point where the bill probably wouldn't have actually done much at all to ban these types of weapons. The main issue that she raised was that assault rifles would be needed for invasive species control. Kind of a procedural thing with this. So this late in the legislative session, a floor amendment in one chamber is basically a death sentence for a bill because the other chamber would then need to simultaneously pass that floor amendment as well. And so, you know, after a lot of confusion, they were unsure of like the votes and stuff. They finally did decide to amend the bill to that floor amendment in a 3-12 vote with Senate President Ron Cochi breaking the tie. And, you know, basically this meant that the bill would then be deferred back to committee, and then the House had no choice but to do the same. Kind of the extraordinary measures of this is that, you know, usually the Senate president does not break from the subject matter committee chair's vote. And in this case, the subject chair was Senator Carl Rhodes, who chairs the Judiciary Committee. He also introduced the assault rifle ban bill. So Senator Rhodes obviously did not vote for this amendment, and Senator Cochi broke with him to cast that tie-breaking vote to then amend it to the floor amendment. Another surprise vote on that floor amendment was Senator Glenn Wakai, who was actually one of the introducers of the assault rifle ban. He voted in favor of the amendment as well. And when we say that this bill died, it technically can come back next session because we're on, a biennium. And so all the bills that don't make it through this session can come back next session. But for this year, the assault rifle ban bill is not going to pass.
Yeah, and I'm sure folks are disappointed because they fear that something bad could happen.
Right. And that's exactly what some of the gun safety advocates were saying. And, you know, one of them told me, you know, these assault rifles are usually the weapons of choice for mass shootings. And that's why they thought it was so important to get this passed. And it was really at the finish line and at the very last second. You know, anything can happen to these bills, even out of committee.
Yeah, there's always some high drama.
Yes. But they did pass a lot of things yesterday as well. Pretty much everything that we've been paying attention to this legislative session, with the exception of the climate impact fee or the green fee bill. And they'll be voting on that on Friday because there was some issues with the, like, technical language that they found in there. They made a mistake, and so they wanted to fix that, and they fixed it yesterday, and so they will be voting on that on Friday. But when we're looking at what did pass yesterday, the big bill, which you heard about earlier, is the securitization and liability caps for Hawaiian Electric. The bill they passed would allow the Public Utilities Commission to set a liability cap for Hawaiian Electric Company in the event of another catastrophic wildfire. The governor would then have final approval on that liability cap, although that governor check on the Public Utilities Commission is a little bit unclear because there was some confusion on the floor about whether or not HECO would qualify under the definition of an electric, the definition of what would be under this governor check is unclear if that would qualify for Hawaiian Electric. The Attorney General told Energy and Environmental Protection Chair Nicole Lowen that HECO does qualify under that and that the governor would have the final say after the Public Utilities Commission set that liability cap. But that's something that that was kind of left unclear yesterday. The bill would also allow Hawaiian Electric to take out bonds for infrastructure upgrades backed by customers, and that's what's called securitization. And that would mean a fee could be added to people's electric bills to pay for the needed upgrades if certain conditions are met by the utility company, like it has to follow its wildfire mitigation plan. The bill would cap the amount the utility can securitize at about $500 million. Most lawmakers were in agreement about securitization itself, which they say is necessary because it would allow the utility company to borrow funds at a lower interest rate and actually save consumers money versus if they borrowed the funds without securitization because HECO's credit rating is so low right now because of what happened in Lahaina. However, in order for HECO to securitize, they have to be in compliance with a bunch of things and then also, you know, be following its wildfire mitigation plan.
A lot of people saw this really as a bailout bill for Hawaiian Electric because they feared that if Hawaiian Electric goes under, who knows who's going to come set up shop.
Exactly. And I think that was kind of where the lofty debate happened on the floor yesterday about this bill, which is about the liability cap that would be placed on Hawaiian Electric. The most surprising was that both Consumer Protection Committee chairs in the House and the Senate spoke in opposition to the bill. And the issue is that the Public Utilities Commission would be able to choose a liability cap that could either be per disaster or over a certain time frame. So here's Representative Scott Matayoshi and then Senator Jared Keohokulole.
The bill unfairly favors certain wildfire victims over others. And honestly, I don't even think we should be pitting wildfire victims against each other to begin with. Unfortunately, when I spoke to the PUC and asked them their opinion on what they were leaning towards, the PUC told me that if given the choice, they were going to be leaning towards the time frame option because they thought that was more predictable. And they're right that it would make HECO's liability more predictable in that time frame because it would be capped. But I honestly think that's the wrong choice.
Let's pause here because that part is not a detail. It's the core of the bill, inserted in the shadows at the very end of the legislature. If the PUC chooses to set a cap for a time period, say 10 years, which has been proposed in some conversations, and multiple wildfires happen during that time, the utility could be shielded from full responsibility for all those fires combined. It's crazy. One cap, multiple fires, and a hard limit on how much they owe.
Representative Nicole Lowen, who chairs the House Energy and Environmental Protection Committee, who did a lot of work on this bill, says she also spoke with the PUC and says that they don't know which way they would go, if it would be a liability cap per event or over a period of time. She says she sees this as a way she sees this as a setup giving the PUC and the public more time to look at this issue.
But I do think that with the process that we're setting up, we're going to have an opportunity to give this difficult question the kind of time and analysis and resources that it deserves and that we really can't do in the time frame of a legislative session. So it's not perfect, but it's my firm belief that we're doing something positive for customers here and we're really trying to find a way to move forward. I understand the idea of a liability cap is concerning to victims or potential future victims, but the reality is that there's a real liability cap already. It's not like the utility paid an unlimited amount in the current settlement for Lahaina. And so I think it's just providing, it's not necessarily that we want to provide less than that, but just providing some certainty.
And as a reminder of the $4.2 billion global settlement that's still being negotiated, HECO is contributing about $2 billion and the state share is about $800 million.
Yeah, so what else passed?
Yeah, I think one of the other major bills that passed was about property insurance stabilization, which is creating another way for the state to issue insurance policies of last resort to buildings that have been unable to secure property insurance, essentially, because, you know, we've seen these skyrocket insurers pulling out of some buildings. And so basically this would allow the Hawaii Property Insurance Association to issue some policies as a last resort. And they're saying that these policies could be available by summer if Governor Green does sign this into law and it does, you know, become a law. The measure would also allow the condominiums to take out loans provided through the state for infrastructure repairs for fire sprinklers and pipes. And those are kind of the two major issues of why a lot of buildings are losing their insurance coverage, because they don't have those fire sprinklers or their pipes are really old and broken.
Yeah, but it's an important issue because it does affect so many people here across the state. Well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
We've been hearing from HBR's government reporter Ashley Mizzou as we near the end of the session. It is the first day of the month, so we have to take a break to test the emergency alert system. Stay with us.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
This Sunday, Hawaii Public Radio brings you the last performance from our Live from the Atherton Mele Hawaii series. Enjoy music from Hi'ikua. Join us for Live from the Atherton with Hi'ikua Sunday at 4 p.m. on HPR 1, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from ESI, Environmental Science International, an engineering and consulting firm specializing in assessment, remediation, and compliance planning. e-science-i.com.
May Day is Lay Day. That's the phrase first penned in 1927 by Don Blanding and Grace Tower Warren in the Honolulu Star Bulletin. Their idea was to celebrate the tradition of lei making on the 1st of May took hold, and this year marks the 97th Lei Day. Its creator, Don Blanding, was born in Oklahoma and settled in Honolulu in the 1920s. Blanding was also recognized as a poet. He published sponsored poems daily in the Honolulu Star Bulletin that featured the Ajinomoto brand of MSG. He also crafted poems from the heart, including the one he may be best known for. It begins like this. When I have a house, as I sometime may, it'll suit my fancy in every way. I'll fill it with things that have caught my eye in drifting from Iceland to Molokai. For today's quiz, can you name this poem by Don Blanding? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right scores an HBR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
President Donald Trump's executive orders have triggered more than 200 lawsuits. Hawaii has joined other Democratic states in at least 14 of the legal challenges. State Attorney General Ann Lopez was joined by two of her deputies at a forum yesterday who were passionate about taking on a fight for the rule of law and the Constitution. They appeared in a forum at the University of Hawaii William S. Richardson School of Law. HPR was there among the law students and the faculty to hear Lopez, Solicitor General Kaliko Fernandez, and Deputy Attorney General David Day. Hawaii is leading or co-leading the fight in two cases. It has been a whirlwind of legal curveballs. We start with Lopez.
Elected and appointed government officials of both parties have failed to uphold their sworn duty to their respective state constitutions and the United States Constitution by staying silent. The Democratic attorneys general, I believe, are from a government perspective, we are really the last line holding the rule of law and trying to hold this administration accountable. Every day there's a new EO or a new action or some new crazy thing that happens. The Democratic attorneys general and our staffs meet sometimes daily, sometimes not. The staff usually meet daily to talk about the newest issues, whether or not they do in fact violate the law, because we're not going to waste our time fighting against things that the president can legally do. We talk about whether or not those harms are impacting Hawaii to determine whether or not as states we have standing to sue the federal government. We talk about what state or states want to take lead if we decide to go forward with litigation. And those decisions are made collaboratively, and they're based on expertise, interest, and most certainly resources.
You know, we spoke with the three lawyers following the forum. You know, you could hear the conviction in their voices. They see this as an unprecedented battle over democracy, the Constitution, the rule of law, and civil rights. And never in recent times has the importance of public service law has been so clear. You don't often hear about the work of our state attorneys in such high-profile cases. Here's AG Ann Lopez again.
After 100 days of this, I feel honored that I get to lead this team and that our office is actively involved. And secondly, I'd say because of the deputies that I have in the department, Hawaii is able to make a real impact in what's happening in this litigation throughout the United States. We play an important role. We're not there just for the ride, but we are impacting this work every day. It's important to me that people in Hawaii know that we are fighting every day. The state is fully engaged, and every time their rights or they're somehow impacted by Trump's illegal activity, we're gonna step in and we're gonna fight back.
What's the most frustrating thing for you? Is it when a case doesn't have the broad reach that folks might hope, that it's, you know, it's limited, and this whole back and forth between the executive branch and the judicial branch, and, you know, the lower courts can't tell me what to do, that's overreach?
This is part of our judicial process. This is the way our government works with three branches. We need to be patient. The back and forth with the judiciary is the way our courts have been working for a really long time. So we can't get frustrated about it. The courts and the judiciary are working the way they are supposed to work. Everything is so interconnected, right? I understand that 30% of the children in Hawaii live in food insecurity. So they stop funding for the food bank. A $500,000 delivery is stopped. They stop free lunches. They stop SNAP. So it's not that any one case is important. It's that all of these agencies are integrated in one way or another to help people for specific reasons. And I think that we have to keep looking at that larger picture, because there's a ripple effect. Every time they do one thing, it's going to impact some other agency or some other grant. And so I just think that we have to keep that big picture in mind as we're working on the individual cases.
And the deputies working on this team aren't just dedicated to these challenges. It is on top of their regular workload as state lawyers. Solicitor General Kaliko Fernandez talked about the importance of Hawaii being part of the birthright citizenship case.
So the birthright citizenship case was the very first case we filed. The Trump administration, within hours of taking office, issued an executive order that would essentially redefine what, for a century, we have understood birthright citizenship to mean and the 14th Amendment to mean. And so, you know, we sued immediately under the theory that this was unconstitutional, clearly unlawful, violative of binding U.S. Supreme Court precedent. So I think this case, again, our first, is really demonstrative of our work to stand up for the rule of law, to put the guardrails on the system, to say, you know, this is clearly violative of existing law, and to be one of the, you know, there are a number of birthright citizen lawsuits. All of them thus far have gone against the government, but to be one of the many sort of standing up for this principle.
And then how has the office approach joining some of the other states? Because I know in some cases the courts, the higher courts, are limiting it to, you know, just the plaintiffs, as opposed to a sweeping decision freezing everything that's happening.
When a new policy comes down or something new interpretation happens, really what we look at is two main things, you know, whether this violates some constitutional mandate, a statute, a regulation, and also how it affects Hawaii. And so a lot of that work is on the ground with our client agencies, with our state employees, to understand what the potential effects are. For example, if we've just got a funding stream cut, what does that mean? Is the work going to have to stop? Are people's jobs going to be affected by this? So that's a huge part of this work, is assessing the impacts to the state. And if we do feel like both of those things are true, that this is unlawful, that it is negatively harming the state, that often counsels in favor of us joining together with other states to try to challenge the policy. And I think, as A.G. Lopez has mentioned, it's quite a collaborative group. I think we're better together in pooling our resources, pooling our expertise to get these cases filed in court.
What does it mean to you personally, knowing that really this is probably the fight of your career? I mean, it's just so important.
It is so important. I've said this before, but I have a lot left in my career. I'm sort of relatively young, and I am very confident that this will be one of the most important things I've ever done. I think it's just been so fulfilling. There's something fulfilling about public service. There's something invigorating and fulfilling about seeing the harms that are happening to our people and then being able to do something tangible about it. It doesn't mean that we will always succeed, but I think there's so much importance through the leadership of A.G. Lopez in doing something to respond.
And during this forum, somebody sent in a note about how appreciative they were.
Yeah, we have a little wall in our office of messages that we've gotten from people in Hawaii and quite frankly across the country, thanking us for the work we're doing and recognizing, you know, some of these people have been affected directly by these policies. And so it is so meaningful to hear from those people, to know that we are having an impact and that people are appreciative of what we're doing.
And here's Attorney David Day again talking about the Office of Budget and Management case that he holds out as indicative of the fight against the Trump administration. It's called New York versus Trump, and it was filed in Massachusetts.
That case arose after a memorandum was issued on January 27th, 2025, by the acting director of OMB, which basically said all federal funds flowing to the states, to the counties, to municipalities, to nonprofits are going to be shut off. And the reason why it was being shut off is they believed that some of the funds may have been used to fund, quote, woke projects. And they then went on to define those as things that would assist immigrants, affect transgender individuals, the Green New Deal, and DEI initiatives. But basically all that fell under this concept of wokeness, and because of that, turned off all the money. The next day we woke up and all of the money in the state of Hawaii was turned off. And that includes not just kind of, you know, random projects that you've never heard of, but the ones that we depend upon, like Medicaid and SNAP. We're talking about billions of dollars. The attorneys general sued, and within that process obtained a preliminary injunction that ordered the Trump administration to stop its practice of freezing federal funds to the states that had filed suit, including Hawaii. This has in turn unlocked over $1 billion in funds, federal funds flowing to the state of Hawaii, and is really in many ways the cornerstone of the defense of the state against Trump administration policies.
And you also talked about the tactics. So address some of that.
Sure. This kind of gets into sort of our experience in dealing with the United States Department of Justice as reflected in the record. We have a grant that's called Solar for All. It's a $60+ million grant that was given to the Hawaii Green Infrastructure Authority. That was one of the first grants that was suspended by the federal government, and it had been suspended for quite a while. One day, without any prompting, it was approximately 3 days before the hearing on the motion for preliminary injunction, the grant turned on. And we were all very surprised. Wow, it turned on. Later that weekend, it turned off again after the hearing was completed. I'm not saying that there is a correlation, but it certainly was something that raised our eyebrows. And we also note that there have been multiple instances of where we've had to fight for specific grants to be turned on, where it took substantial delay for grants to be turned back on. And certainly with respect to FEMA grants, that has been an issue that we had to fight for and get an order mandating that the federal government comply with an already existing preliminary injunction order. The passion that I think and the belief in the mission that really drives us forward. There's a lot of long nights. There's a lot of days where you're really questioning, you know, whether you should be devoting this much time to it. But it becomes very clear once you think about it that the rule of law in this country is under threat. Democracy is under threat. Civil rights are under threat. And we at the Attorney General's office have an ability to do something about it. And it's tremendously invigorating.
That was Deputy Attorney General David Day. We also heard from Solicitor General Calico Fernandez and State Attorney General Ann Lopez. They spoke yesterday at a forum at the UH Richardson School of Law. You know, the 1st of May is celebrated as International Workers' Day. And today, hundreds of union members from a couple of dozen entities are planning to gather for a silent march from the state capitol to the federal building. We talked to the IBW Workers' Union Representative, Dion Dizon, who says the show of support for federal employees who have lost their jobs or have had their collective bargaining contracts set aside is important during these unprecedented times.
It's really a time for labor to kind of come together, not in a loud way, but in a way to just a silent show of strength, a way for the community to join hands and to come in to support federal workers, and not just federal workers, but all workers, because we are just the front line of it, and the trickle down will happen. This is the one thing that will trickle down and hit the ground here in Hawaii. And so in addition to that, I think part of it is being able to have the community come out, because federal workers are the most sensitive to what comes out of any orders and guidance that comes out. They're going to feel it first. And to be quite frank, like some of them are, you know, they're concerned about retaliation, and so some may not actually be able to come out and march on their own behalf. However, it's like if we have community that has courage to come out to support them, that's what this is about today. Collective bargaining rights in the federal sector have not been extinguished, but we are still in the fight and in the thick of it to ensure that the president cannot legislate by executive order. That is strictly, you know, something that's done by Congress. And that, you know, it's going to take, so all of the things that are happening, it'll take time to challenge and it'll take time to get a ruling. And until then, you know, we have to just stand together.
Well, share with our listeners, because your union represents a number of federal workers, you know, your members have been affected in so many different ways.
Yes, we administer 8 different Department of Defense civilian employee bargaining units. And for IBEW Local 1186, our workers are from Space Force Kaena Point out to the Kaneohe Marine Corps base, out to Bellows. And although we're an electricians union, the composition of our bargaining units range from sandwich artists, you know, because we have AFIs and we have retail workers, all the way up to engineers. And so very, very broad range of people. However, with the things that have been going on, and this is why our members have been on the front end of this, like from the very beginning. And just for example, when the orders came out about the DEI and the shutting those agencies, the Wednesday after inauguration in January, I had a bargaining unit employee who was put immediately on administrative leave, so paid admin leave. However, it was pending non-disciplinary removal. And so that was the first hit that I was aware of, because when you think about this, our workers are protected by a collective bargaining agreement. Excluded from the agreement are supervisors, managers, and some supervisors, there's no collective bargaining obligation. And so to that point, for the probationary firings, I had a former bargaining unit member who took a promotion in a different agency into a supervisory position. And he started work at the end of January. And on Valentine's Day, February 14th, he was fired under this, the probationary firing.
How long had he been in government service?
To my recollection, about 15 years prior, before he, you know, applied for that. And so it's, you know, lives are being disrupted for sure. You know, a member bought a home, and by virtue of being told she had to return to work, it was possible that all of this would just fall apart. I think the main point is just saying that there's real impact and real consequences to the decisions that are being made at what people might feel like is at the 50,000 foot level, that it may feel like it's happening way high up. However, it has real impacts on the ground and for real people.
Right. These are your neighbors, your uncle, your auntie.
Yes. Across the 8 different bargaining units, one of them is the Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard. And each of these DOD, you know, employers have been, the labor management approach and response has been different. And so at the shipyard in particular, they decided to fast track an executive order, of which as of April 28th, portions have been deemed unlawful or ruled unlawful. Not only the executive order, but also subsequent guidance. However, it's not only causing instability in the workplace for employees, but supervisors were also reaching out to the union because they were being told the CBA doesn't apply, just unilaterally ignoring the contract. And it caused confusion for everybody. You know, nobody knew how to act. So like, the supervisors were coming to the union. What do we do now? How we do this?
And when you reference CBA, the collective bargaining agreement?
Yes, collective bargaining agreement. And so for the federal workers, you know, we don't negotiate benefits because that's the function of Congress. However, you know, for working conditions and conditions of employment, actually. So removal of, you know, this whole function, you know, this structure. I mean, this is just well-established working relationship. And
it's out the window.
One employer decides to just out the window. One employer decides to do that. And even to the point of being told, you know, it's like, oh, we don't know yet, but possibly by tomorrow, May 2nd, you're going to get notice to get out of this space. And so we're challenging all of it. And so there's just a bunch of things going on, but just the lack of surgical precision. And maybe it's intended to overwhelm.
Well, you know, we did hear the Secretary of Defense, when he came through here on his visit, Mr. Hegseth, that he was asking for a plan for a reduction, I think, for the DOD. And, you know, while we hear that Indo-PACOM, the Indo-Pacific Command, is exempt from some cuts, everybody's still pretty nervous.
Yeah, so what happened in terms of the cuts, the quickest way to get rid of a federal government employee is to have them leave on their own. And so when you take a look at, you know, the probationary firings, you perceive that probationary workers have the least amount of rights. However, federal government employees have a property interest in their job. And so that's why when you saw the whipsaw of, you know, hey, they're all fired. Oh, hey, you got to bring them back. And it was because it was unlawful because they were being divested of property without just cause or without compensation. And so they had to be reinstated. And that didn't happen for everybody. Now, in terms of the fast forward, it's like, so you have probation or firing. You have people who voluntarily quit because they don't want to return to work if they were on remote work or telework agreement. And then you had the deferred resignation programs, which now they're buying out federal government employees. And to the point of that, the thing that they signed, one of the provisions said that if this is determined to be unlawful, that the employer reserves the right to put you in an alternate leave status, which may include leave without pay.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, you know, like they wrote things in there, but people still took them. And so they're floating things out saying we have the right to do this as a voluntary program. However, case like precedents will show that they're still supposed to meet collective bargaining obligations because this affects their future work life.
You know, we have seen statements about how there are plans to not just push aside the collective bargaining agreement for TSA, but other specific departments within the federal government. So, you know, the whole Civil Service Act. So that's being threatened as well. I understand that you were at that law school forum yesterday because you're an alum. Well, what were you struck by? What was your takeaway?
I think because it doesn't always feel like people are paying attention, and I get that not everybody's feeling this equally. What I really took away was the fact that there are people fighting on so many different fronts or resisting on so many different fronts. And David Day actually said this, and I wrote it down, that it's really having the passion for the mission of believing we can do something to preserve this nation. And that the work, we're really working to retain what's good.
All right.
So that was something that really struck me yesterday.
All right. Well, you know, Dionne, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate your willingness to carve out that for us.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Dionne Dizon of the IBEW Local Union 1186, who represents federal workers who have lost their jobs either through cuts of probationary staff or in programs targeted by the Trump administration. Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we tipped our hats to Lay Day and learned about its creation nearly a century ago by Grace Tower Warren and Don Blanding. Make a lay, wear a lay, give a lay is a motto of this annual celebration. And for today's quiz, we wanted to know more about the tradition's creator, Don Blanding. Blanding was a writer, artist, and poet. Later in his life, he designed Hawaiian-themed tableware for the ceramic company Vernon Kilns. One of Blanding's best-known poems tells of a house he yearns to live in, filled with the mementos from his travels. The poem was inspired by a real house that he owned in Carmel by the Sea, California. We asked you for the title of this poem. It is Vagabond House. And for fun, here's how the poem ends. This house that I'll have in some far day, well, it's a dream house anyway. And we stumped you on the quiz question. We had no winners today. But that's our quiz. If you have one to share, write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. And happy Lay Day. Today on The Long View, we talk about mass transit, where it works and where it doesn't. Well, at least not here yet. Joining us this morning in studio is our contributing editor, Neil Milner. Good morning.
Good morning. I drove down.
Okay. Well, you know, my experience is limited. I love the BART train in San Francisco in the Bay Area, the subway in New York, and the T in Boston. That's what I've been on.
Well, this story I'm going to talk about, which was in City Lab by a researcher on public transportation named Jonathan English, shows that it's possible to have good mass transit in a place that's not the kind of places that you describe, which were highly dense urban areas. So I'm going to talk about a place called Brampton, Ontario. If you've ever been to Toronto, you know that there's large suburbs around there. Brampton, Ontario is basically a city in lots of ways. It's 700,000 people. At the same time, it has, because it's, it has a lot of sprawl, a lot of single-family homes and all that, wide streets. At the same time, they got warehouses, Amazon warehouses there. It's not the kind of place that you think would be successful overwhelmingly to get people to ride buses. And yet, they've developed a bus system that gets far more ridership per capita than other cities of its size in the United States. Columbus, Ohio, Chicago, it's been phenomenally successful. And essentially, it's just buses. There's nothing else going on down the line. So the interesting thing to look at is how this happened. Now, I want to make clear here, this is not about a woulda, coulda, shoulda in regard to Skyline, in regard to Honolulu Rail. We'll come back to that in a minute. But I don't want to just make this sound like that's what we should have done. But it's interesting for some other reasons why it's valuable to have this kind of information. So here's the story of Brampton, right? It's got all these things I talked about. The city leaders were thinking of developing a light rail system. And the city manager had a lot to do with saying, let's try something else. Let's try a massive bus, public bus system. And that's essentially what they did. What they did was essentially to add a lot of buses, and their goal was to get choice riders, that's the term of art, that is people who have a choice, don't have to ride the bus, to get them into buses.
Mm-hmm. And they've leave the car at home.
Yeah, right. That's right. So, you know, I mean, I rode the bus a lot when I was a kid because we didn't have a car, right? I had no choice. And they've been able, and what they've done, what they did was to gradually do this. They started with what they could start with. They built demand. The demand kept increasing, and they flood the zone. The buses run so often in so many different ways, including off hours, which is important because they have a lot of people. Workers don't just work 9 to 5. You've got a lot of warehouse workers, and Amazon was delighted because they've got a warehouse there. Mm-hmm. You just flooded the zone so that there now are so many buses on the streets of Brampton that people really don't even have to look at the schedule. They just get on. And so it's been an exception because it's been able to do this in a place that other places that look like it, like part of Southern California, parts of Chicago, haven't been able to do. And it's on basically simple principles. That is, you do it incrementally. You have to be very careful to develop enough buses as you go along to increase demand and then to increase the supply of buses as you go along.
Build as you go, right?
Yeah, but that's it. So I was very much intrigued by it. You know, transportation, people who like to ride on trains and that kind of stuff don't find buses sexy. You know, I'm a train guy. I love to ride on trains. I don't think that much about buses, but that's beside the point, really, because if you can get people to ride them here. Now, let's briefly look at how Skyline was developed in a different way and then go back to some of these principles. Someone has to write a history of Skyline because there is a lot there that's about the history of Honolulu, about the history of the culture and the politics at that time when big was better. We have a lot of mythology, a lot of anger about how that happened. I don't know. But we do know for sure that you built a system in which you could not gradually increase demand. You couldn't gradually get people to come out because you have to wait so long before you get started. And now, as Roger Morton points out, but in kind of less direct ways than I am, it's hard to induce demand if the rail doesn't run anywhere, mm-hmm. right? And so essentially you have this huge infrastructure that's not going to go away, that's going to keep getting bigger, and that's going to lag behind inducing demand for a long time, even if it can get it later, because remember, our early projections were based on a route that's rather different.
Yes.
So we have to live with that and maybe adjust to it, whatever. But I think there's some really interesting principles here about how, and politics here about how we have to think about doing things. There's a couple of things going on that are important, one of which is that Trump is not a public administration fan, not a public transportation fan. So you're not going to get money from him. Republicans are less likely anyway to want to give money for public transit. So we may have to move toward less sexy but smaller scale solutions. There's a recent bit of research about trains that it makes some sense to consider generally. So for years, the Biden administration did this. Other people have said, we need more trains. We need more commuter trains. We need more trains that go 500 miles, you know, that go 500 miles or less. You need more trains to get more people on. Trains are expensive. Building an infrastructure for it really makes it expensive. So they did some research on existing trains. And they discovered a couple of things that can increase the speed of routes almost as much as if you developed high-speed rail, one of which is you lower the platforms because just getting on and off platforms, especially, let's say, if this is a commuter train from the suburbs. The other, and I never would have thought about either one of those, the other is to replace diesel locomotives with electric locomotives. Now, this is not what this is, you know, our island here doesn't have this kind of stuff. Diesel locomotives accelerate much faster. And you're saving, those two things save a lot of time. Now, I'm not saying we should develop those things, but it's a reminder that we may have to go back and look at more, less sexy, more low-tech solutions that get us somewhere. So I think that those are important. And this is moving a little far asunder. But I think about this kind of stuff when I think about how the stadium is being developed. Because the politicians and the developers keep talking about this big entertainment district. It's not just, it's an entertainment district. It's big, it's grandiose, it'll take years to develop. If you watch what kind of letters to the editor that come out a lot of times, they basically say, we just want the freaking stadium. What is all this other stuff? This may be a situation where it's about inducing demand. That is, you build, let's say, the stadium first. You don't keep trying to sell it as this bigger project, and then over time you do it. I think politics may move more into that direction.
Yeah, well, I think some folks are looking at that as a Trojan horse for gambling, right? So,
well, that's right, but that's even more grandiose, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah. And you know, gambling here, as you saw in this state of legislature, raises a lot of emotion, you know, ire, wishfulness, and so on. But as soon as you do that, as soon as you become grandiose with your plans, you may think that you're mobilizing more people because you're pulling more people in. You may, in a sense, be making people more cynical about government, which is not exactly what you need in Hawaii because it's too big and we can't do anything that big.
Yeah, well, I remember being the City Hall reporter when we were going back and forth on rail, and there were a couple of council members that were all in support of bus rapid transit.
Oh, you know? Yeah. I mean, we talked about it. That's why I really don't. I'm not saying that we had the infrastructure to do that. I remember some of it was you can't build bus lanes. I don't know. Maybe that's true. Maybe there are ways to do it without building bus lanes. That's not my main point here. You've had enough people come in on rail. But it'd be interesting for you to sit down and think about what kind of assumptions that people make about what rail could do at the time. When I came here in the 60s, there was all kinds of weird plans about mass transit, including widening Manoa Stream and running boats down and all that kind of stuff in the ferry. So there was a lot of creative thinking in a sort of broad, sexy sort of way. But it may turn out that creativity will move in the other direction, where you look for little things that make big differences that you don't try to sell as, you know, the beginning of a new world.
Yeah, well, I think we ought to meet at Pearl Ridge and go jump on the Manoa rail talk about this.
The interesting thing about rail is that it's a scenic ride. You get to see views coming out of coming toward Pearl Harbor.
It's stunning.
It really is stunning.
It really is, yeah. It's a good field trip. Well, thank you so much, Neil.
As if that's going to make it go,
But, we should go on the monorail, though. That would be fun.
Yeah, sure. Anytime.
All right. Thanks so much. Sure. We have been talking to our contributing editor, Neil Milner, and we'll have links to the article that he mentioned on our website later today. Well, that is it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to air a special broadcast from NPR on the first 100 days of Donald Trump's second term is in office. What do you think? Weigh in. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.